I'm Dr. Brian Goldman, host of the CBC podcast, The Dose. Each week, we answer vital health questions that will help you thrive, like, what does my mental health have to do with my gut? How can I prevent melanoma? How much sleep do I really need? And how can I manage my health without a family doctor? I chat with the top experts to bring you the latest evidence in plain language, all in about 20 minutes. Find The Dose on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Nora Young. This is Spark and our special series, The Butterfly Effect. A central idea of chaos theory is that changes to initial conditions of a system will affect its outcomes. There's a classic metaphor for illustrating this. Something as small as a butterfly flapping its wings on one side of the ocean can lead to a tornado on the other side. In other words, a seemingly minor action can set a system on a massively different course of events. And that's what we're focusing on in this series. Over the course of 10 episodes, we'll look at small inventions that have gone on to change the world. So much so that it's hard to imagine what life would be like without them. Welcome to The Butterfly Effect. Okay, here I am in the kitchen. I've just put my toast on and I'm going to make myself a cappuccino. And then I'm going to have breakfast while listening to the news on the radio. I'll be right back.
From CBC News, it's the World of
Ready for the day and this new series we're doing on Spark. You see, all the devices I use to make my little radio breakfast, from the toaster to the coffee machine to even my radio, have one very small thing in common. They all contain integrated circuits, or microchips. In fact, pretty much every powered device we use these days depends on microchips, from a car to the electric guitar used in the music that's playing under my voice. By some estimates, the average North American household contains many thousands of microchips, all discreetly and silently making the things we take for granted possible. It's hard to believe that as recently as the 1970s, almost nothing in the home contained an integrated circuit, and they were only being used experimentally in industrial-sized computers. So in this episode of The Butterfly Effect, the amazing influence of the microchip.
If you look at a modern automobile, it just has, people joke about it, it's a computer that happens to have four wheels on it. My name is Paul Cerussi. I am a retired curator from the Smithsonian Institution.
Paul Cerussi is uniquely placed to tell us about integrated circuits. He's a Fulbright scholar and the author of 8 books on the evolution of computer technology. He's also curator emeritus of the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum. As such, Paul's watched computers go from warehouse-filling vacuum tube monsters to devices the size of a fingernail. He's also seen how small technological advances have changed the world in dramatic ways.
Well, there's a lot of disagreement among historians about where the computer age began, but I would say it was the 1930s and 1940s, and the earliest machines that you could call a computer worked with mechanical switches, just like an adding machine. Just imagine a whole bunch of adding machines linked together or something. They had the drawback of being too slow. To do a computation of any kind of complexity, you have to do thousands and thousands of additions and subtractions. The reason they were abandoned is that they were too slow. They went to the vacuum tube electronics, which switch thousands of times faster. The vacuum tube is a kind of extension of a familiar Edison light bulb. It uses a filament which gives off electrons. Hence the term electronic. The electrons are then gathered at a plate inside the tube. And by inserting another unit in there, you can switch that flow on and off, just like a light switch. And if you have thousands of these switches, you create enough complexity to do complex calculations.
we could say that practical computing didn't begin until we had the capability to compute, which was enabled by, of course, the invention of the transistor. You know, I think that we can certainly go well before that and, you know, look at things further back in history and say that the fundamentals were put in place, much before that. But in the end, you needed to have the capability of scaling, which was enabled by modern microelectronics. I'm John Del Sassi. I'm a professor of electrical and computer engineering at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. I teach classes on semiconductor devices and photonics and do research on photonics, especially novel lasers, looking at new wavelength ranges and things like that.
In his work as an engineering professor, John researches the cutting edge of chip technology, working on ever faster, smaller, and more efficient ways of processing information.
Even before we had the transistor, we had, vacuum tube-based electronics, and we had computers that were the size of the room that I'm in that could do the same types of calculations that your hand calculator or your cell phone can do today. Perhaps your cell phone has more capability than those early vacuum tube-based computers. You could never have a computer of the same kind of scale you do today using vacuum tubes. When you think about a vacuum tube, it's, about, let's say, a square inch on a side. If you were to try to put together something that had a million vacuum tubes, which is a fraction of what we have in a modern computer as far as number of transistors. Well, first of all, you'd be changing vacuum tubes all the time, because none of them would last long enough to do any kind of calculation. But it would be something that would be just a circuit board to put that on would be larger than a football stadium, right? I mean, which, of course, is just practically impossible to contemplate. So, we needed to have the transistor and the capability to scale things down to the sort of nanoscale that things are today in order to allow both the densification as well as power dissipation, all of those things that enable much more complex circuits to be put together like today's modern microprocessors.
And how important was the invention of the transistor to the development of computing and ultimately to the integrated circuit?
Well, the vacuum tubes did a great job, but they consume a lot of power. They give off a lot of heat. And just like a light bulb, they occasionally burn out. So if you've got thousands of them and one of them burns out, the whole computer stops working. So they had issues like reliability and heat. So coincidentally, the transistor was invented around the same time in the late 1940s, not specifically for computers, but for telephone switching. But it was a way of realizing that there needed to be some kind of switch of a kind, which did not use vacuum tubes or mechanical switches. And the transistor had the advantage of doing those switches. That switching in pure solid state, primarily an element called germanium, later on silicon, which is just below it on the periodic table.
And so they didn't have the problem of essentially burning out the way the vacuum tubes did.
That's right. It was much, much better. However, and this is where we're getting to our story here, is that you need thousands of them. And they have to be wired by hand, soldered, and or some kind of wiring. And if you look at pictures of these old transistorized computers, you see this maze of wires, very, very complex things. And again, just like with the vacuum tube, one vacuum tube blows and the machine stops working. Well, if somebody made a mistake with one wire, you got a problem. So the complexity was an issue. And that sort of was one of the driving forces to lead to the integrated circuit.
And so did the invention of the integrated circuit come about because engineers wanted faster computing, or was it sort of a happy coincidence? Can you walk me through that?
They realized that any computing device would need a large number of transistors and other components like resistors as well. And they saw that you could take a sliver of material, germanium was the first one that was used, and you could put these transistors on there using a photo technique somewhat similar to the way you make microfilm. Although I don't know who remembers microfilm anymore, but the idea that you could photo etch the circuits. We're getting ahead of ourselves because it took a lot of research to get that to work. But you could photo etch the circuits on a single piece of material, and you could create a basic logic unit of a computer. So it was there was a lot of people were working on this, and eventually they came up with a solution.
So essentially, you're avoiding the problem of having to actually make the transistors and connect the wires and all that kind
That's
of stuff.
That's right. The connections are now done photographically, etching. It's not really etching, but it's like photographic etching. And you do have to have connections, but you have the standard thing was to have a printed circuit where you stuff the chips onto a circuit board and you had some solder on the bottom, and it was a very, very efficient and effective way of making a complex machine.
Mm. So before we go too much further, Paul, we should probably explain some terms. Can you tell me about the difference between a semiconductor and an integrated circuit and a microchip, or are they all more or less the same thing?
A semiconductor, basically, in classic high school physics, you've got conductors like copper, which conduct electricity very well, glass, which insulates things, insulators. Semiconductors are a unique kind of property of certain elements like silicon or germanium, where if you prepare them properly, they can conduct electricity or hold back electricity depending on the application of another signal from the side, if you wish. And that's the kind of key to the whole computer age that we live in. It depends on the properties of these elements, primarily those two, but there are others as well, gallium, arsenide, and a few others that have these properties. It's weird because electrons, the way we think of electricity, of electrons flowing, actually what happens in a semiconductor is that it's the absence of an electron in the atom that creates a positive charge. It moves in the other direction. They call them holes, believe it or not. Electrons and holes, that's sort of the way they work. It goes back to Ben Franklin. People say he made a mistake. He had the electrons going in the wrong direction or something like that. Anyway, whatever it is, the flow of electricity can be controlled very carefully by the application of a signal from another input. And that's basically how a transistor works.
Yeah, so how significant then was the invention of the integrated circuit?
If you go back to, Kilby and Noyce, who independently had the idea of putting more than one device onto a platform at that point in time, silicon, and also the innovations that allowed that. I mean, going back to Bell Labs, you had people like Carl Frosch who discovered the capability to oxidize silicon. So with that capability to oxidize, coupled with then all of the technology surrounding putting those things together, would you say that the invention of the integrated circuit was as significant as the transistor? I mean, certainly you needed the transistor in order to then contemplate scaling. Perhaps people would have eventually come to that idea of scaling and putting more things together on one chip, but you can't understate the importance of that. I mean, if I had to weigh one versus the other, I'd say, well, we need the transistor first. Yeah. And the physics behind the transistor is subtle in a lot of ways, especially the first transistor. The one enabled the other, but certainly the recognition of Kilby and Noyce and the realization that would ultimately lead to a progression that resulted in, more things, denser things, was certainly, very, very important.
I'm Nora Young. This is Spark, and the first episode of our special 10-part series, The Butterfly Effect. We're exploring how apparently small developments in technology can have an outsized effect on the world and the way many of us live. Right now, I'm talking to John Delasassi, a professor of electrical and computer engineering at the University of Illinois, who holds a couple of dozen patents related to cutting-edge microchip technology. I'm also with Paul Ceruzzi, the curator emeritus at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum. So what can you tell me about the people who came up with the semiconductor?
Well, it was a long process. You know, everybody is aware of this progress in chip density, where now the thing on your handheld phone has more power than the biggest computers of 40 years ago or even 20 years ago. But it took 10 years of research, really, between the late 1940s and 1959 or so, to perfect the process by which you could do that. You had to, first of all, they moved from germanium to silicon. Silicon is a much better element, but it's much harder to work with. They figured out a way to work with silicon. And they figured out a way to purify silicon to an incredibly, silicon is sand, you can find it in the sand, but you have to purify it. They figured out how to do that. They then they discovered a way of making the silicon act in certain ways by what they call doping, which is to add a few molecules of boron or some other chemical as the silicon is being prepared. All of these things took 10 years. So we think of this tremendous advance in computer chip density, but for 10 years, that was zero. There was no, wow. It had to, until they got the final pieces together around 1959. And the crucial step, the final steps were taken in Mountain View, California, what we now call Silicon Valley. But I want to emphasize that the other steps were taken elsewhere as well, primarily in the United States, but also in the UK, in Sprague Electric in North Adams, Massachusetts, Dallas, Texas, Texas Instruments, New Jersey, Bell Laboratories. So there were lots of places where the research was being done. But it was finally in what's now called Silicon Valley, where the pieces all came together.
Yeah. From what I understand, there were these two guys, Jack Kilby and Robert Noyce, who independently came up with the idea. How did they reconcile who got credited with its invention?
Well, I think they sort of agreed to disagree. They both were. Jack was a little bit ahead of the others. But as soon as word got out that he had created a device, this was in Dallas, Texas, Noyce really realized that, yeah, he had to get moving too. And he came up with a version of that, which was more common with what we know today. So, as I say, they agreed to disagree. Noyce, unfortunately, passed away at a relatively young age. Jack lived to get the Nobel Prize in physics.
Mm-hmm. How was the invention received at the time?
That's a good question. They were not universally accepted. There were other techniques for solving this complexity problem. One of the techniques was to deposit these transistors and other devices on a tiny sliver of ceramic. And that had a lot of promise. In fact, IBM used that for its computers. They called it solid logic technology. So that worked. It worked very well. And there were other projects that the Air Force had, something called Tinker Toy, which was a way of assembling the parts almost like that toy. I don't know how many people know what a Tinker Toy is, but a wooden toy that kids played with. Well, so there were lots of competing things. And Kilby told me one time that he went around to all these trade shows and everything with some classified graphs that showed how much better his design was than all these other competitors. And of course, there's the legend, as we all have heard, that the Apollo computer that went to the moon was, they took the very gutsy decision to use integrated circuits at a time when they were still untested. And they used them for the Apollo computer, which of course led to 12 human beings walking on the moon successfully.
Mm-hmm. Can you give me some examples of how the integrated circuit radically changed you know, not just computing, but other areas.
Well, there's a statistic like you're never more than, you know, a certain number of feet from a spider, right? I mean, you know, the same is true with an integrated circuit. I mean, you know, all of us, you know, carry cell phones, you know, we rely on computers. We see integrated circuits in the control systems of our homes, you know, our refrigerators, all the things. You know, we're surrounded by the integrated circuit, and in medical electronics, automotive electronics, entertainment, communications. There are so many ways the transistor has impacted our lives, and of course the semiconductor in general, because obviously there are many other devices besides the transistor that we rely on now for all of those functions. Today's society, and maybe even, you know, the scale of society and you know, the number of people the planet is supporting and everything else, I mean, none of that might be possible if we didn't have the capability to do the sorts of things the transistor has enabled.
Can you talk a bit about Gordon Moore and Moore's Law?
I mean, of course, again, you know, someone whose impact, you know, you can't understate. Gordon Moore himself, you know, principally as, you know, as one of the founders and drivers of Intel and all that Intel has done. Now, I think the original paper on Moore's Law was really more of an observation, right? I mean, he plotted, you know, this trend in scaling of integrated circuit technology, and he said, well, look, this is kind of the trend we're following, and over time, in fact, I don't even think he referred to it as Moore's Law in his paper. He just referred to it as an observation of what was happening. And in order to enable the continued scaling, it followed that progression for many, many years, as long as scaling was possible. But now, of course, we're reaching the level where we're scaling down to the size of crystal itself, right? So we've reached some practical limits as to how far we can go with Moore's Law.
Moore noticed how the density of these chips was going up, doubling every year. He published a little note in a journal saying, well, gee, if this continues, pretty much we'll have a computer in our hand, which sounded ridiculous. But the interesting thing was that Moore was not alone. I think a lot of engineers would keep in their desk drawer a piece of semi-log graph paper. That is to say, time on one axis and a logarithm of density of the chip on the other. And if you draw a straight line, they knew, okay, by 1970 or so, or in the early 70s, we are going to have a chip which is going to have the exact number of transistors on it that the world's first commercial computer, the UNIVAC, had in it. It was vacuum tubes in 1951. They said, so a lot of engineers had that piece of paper in their desk drawer. And Moore was one of them. Now, the question was, okay, you got this density, but that doesn't mean a computer just pops out. They had to figure out how to do it, and that was done, again, at Intel by a number of people. The microprocessor is what they called it. He said that the density would double every year. Eventually, that stretched out to every 18 months, and it sounded ridiculous because the density, for example, the Apollo computer that took people to the moon had only about 5 transistors on it or something. And now we have billions, you know, and on a chip. And people couldn't believe it, but it really did work that way. I think it finally came to an end in the past couple of years, but it was a long ride. And like I say, your smartphone has an incredible amount of power in it. When Moore published that, it kind of became a self-fulfilling prophecy. In other words, a salesman would go to a computer company and say, if you buy our chips, they're going to have this much power. By the time you place the order, they'll be super powerful. And the computer manufacturer say, okay, here's a check, I'm buying them. Then the salesman goes to the engineers that, hey, guess what? I just sold a computer chip that you haven't made yet.
Right. Oh, good.
And the engineer says, oh, okay, really? Yeah, okay. Now go to work. And that's basically right. How it worked. It was a self-fulfilling prophecy, really. And the engineers were hell-bent to do it. Somehow, they did it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm Dr. Brian Goldman, host of the CBC podcast, The Dose. Each week, we answer health topics in a smart and sometimes counterintuitive way you won't hear anywhere else. Like, what's the least amount of exercise I can do to get the benefits? Which psychedelics can improve my mental health? And how can I check for cancer if I don't have a family doctor? Top experts help me bring you what you need to know in plain language in about 20 minutes. Find The Dose on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Nora Young, this is Spark, and the first episode of our special 10-part series, The Butterfly Effect. I've been speaking to John DeLisassi, a professor of electrical and computer engineering at the University of Illinois, and Paul Ceruzzi, curator emeritus of the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum. They'll be back in a short while. If we needed any more proof of our enormous dependence on microchip-enabled devices, we saw it during the COVID pandemic, where people were unable to buy cars and household appliances that can't function without this technology.
Really, it was a story of demand for semiconductors is growing tremendously rapidly because there's more demand for high-performance computing in data centers, which is hugely dependent on semiconductors, because consumer demand for smartphones and PCs continues to grow at a slower rate in the past, continues to grow. And because more and more devices need computing power. And so long as our demand for computing power grows, our need for semiconductors will grow as well. And that happened to a degree that very few people in the industry were expecting in 2020 and 2021.
This is Chris Miller. He teaches international history at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. And a few years ago, he had a realization about the key role semiconductor technology plays in international politics and the global economy.
For example, if you ask how it is that we came to be so reliant on supply chains that crisscross Asia Pacific, the answer is due to chips. Some of the first offshored manufacturing assembly facilities in Asia were from the semiconductor industry, which as early as the 1960s was beginning to construct really complex supply chains that crossed the Pacific Ocean. And when you look at the rise of Asian economies from Japan, Taiwan, South Korea, and then eventually China, these are countries that have focused on chips to drive their technological capabilities, not only making chips themselves, but also the consumer electronics that chips go into. And then finally, if you look at the military balance of power, here too, semiconductors have played a really critical role over the past several decades in shaping how militaries fight wars. So if you imagine, for example, how do you deliver a precision missile to its target? Well, that missile has dozens, or in some cases, hundreds of semiconductors inside. It's communicating with satellites that themselves are full of very specialized semiconductors. And so militaries are more than any other part of our societies or our economies dependent on miniaturized computing power and therefore dependent on semiconductors. And if you project that forward in the future as well and look at what is the U.S. military or the Chinese military investing in, they're investing in systems that will be even more dependent on semiconductors than today's weapon systems.
So how are the microchips made today different from the ones, say, a decade or more ago?
So on each semiconductor are a device called transistors. And a transistor is an electric circuit that's either on or off. If it's on, it creates a one. If it's off, it creates a zero. And these are the ones and zeros that undergird all software and all computing. And the first semiconductors that were invented in the late 1950s and early 1960s had a handful of transistors each. The first commercialized semiconductor had four transistors that was available in the early 60s. Today, if you buy a new iPhone at the store, its primary chip, and it'll have a dozen or so chips in it, but the primary chip will have 10 billion transistors. So that's a several billion-fold increase in the number of transistors and therefore the amount of computing power that a chip will have on it. And so the process of putting lots and lots of transistors on silicon chips is the most complicated manufacturing challenge in human history. today in an iPhone or a new PC, the chips inside will have billions of transistors, each one of which is smaller than a coronavirus. And wow. Chip companies can make these by the many millions a day. If you just take one example of a type of chip, so the say the main processor chip in each iPhone, just to make the processor chip for an iPhone, TSMC, the Taiwanese company that makes these chips, has made one quintillion transistors. That's 10 to the 18th transistors just for one type of chip. So the numbers are mind-boggling because we're talking about devices made at a nanometer scale. And the science and engineering behind this is really the hardest engineering challenges that humans have ever undertaken.
And where are most microchips manufactured today? Is that in Taiwan?
So the manufacturing of chips has shifted pretty dramatically towards East Asia over the past couple of decades. Taiwan is the center of production of processor chips. South Korea is the center of production of memory chips. But to actually make a chip, you need to use designs, ultra-specialized chemicals, some very complicated machine tools that are made in the US, in Japan, and the Netherlands, and in other countries. So you can't actually make an advanced chip using only facilities or tools or software from one country. You need to bring together a handful at least of countries to actually produce the technology that's inside of each chip.
And at this point in 2022, what role does the United States take in microchip design and manufacturing?
The U.S. is still the biggest country by far in the chip industry. By value, most chips are designed in the U.S., whether that's chips that go into data centers, for example, which are designed by Intel or AMD or NVIDIA, chips in your cell phone. If you have an iPhone, Apple itself designs that chip. It's somewhat unique in designing its own chip. Wireless communication is managed by semiconductors today, and there's a number of U.S. firms that play a really critical role in the design of wireless chips. Then if you want to design any sort of chip, you have to use really specialized software. Because chips have so many transistors on them, they're very, very difficult to lay out. You need each of the 10 billion components to be in exactly the right position. So there are three companies that make this software. All three of them are based in the U.S. And finally, most interestingly, I think, are the machine tools that are needed to make semiconductors. And we don't really think about semiconductors is a question of machinery, but if you want to move individual atoms and create transistors at nanometer scale, you need ultra precise machinery. And there's five companies in the world, one in Japan, one in the Netherlands, and three in the US that really have a sort of oligopolistic position in the production of these machine tools, such that it's impossible to operate a semiconductor production facility today without buying these companies' machines. And they can do extraordinary feats of engineering, putting down layers of materials that are just a couple atoms thick, or etching holes in chips that are a couple of atoms wide. I mean, the science behind it is extraordinary, and it needs to be so precise that only a couple of companies can do it. And so that's where the U.S. still has a large role as well. And so although Taiwan and South Korea produce more chips than anyone today, they produce chips using machinery and using software that is largely from the U.S., from Japan, and from the Netherlands.
Do you have any concerns about the oligopolistic nature of that production?
Well, it does create some vulnerabilities. On the one hand, there's a real logic to the fact that there's a small number of firms, which is that it's brutally expensive to make this equipment, and the amount of specialization is such that there's really not much scope in the market to have a large number of firms producing this equipment. To give you one example, the tools that are used to print patterns on semiconductors and therefore lay out where each transistor goes on the chip, these tools cost $150 million a piece, and developing them took three decades. So it's no surprise that only one company today produces these tools, because no one else wants to spend three decades of their own producing comparable tools. So some of the concentration, I think, is just built into the complexity and the cost in the industry. But there are some vulnerabilities that brings up, because when firms are located in geopolitical hotspots, there's a risk of disruption. And I think the best example of that, or the most worrisome example of that, is the case of Taiwan, which today produces around a third of the new computing power we rely on each year, 90% of the most advanced processor chips, and yet just sits right across the Taiwan Straits from a government that wants to take control of the island.
So you've written this book called Chip Wars. Can you tell me a little bit about, I mean, that's a pretty dramatic characterization. How do you see, I guess I would say, like the geopolitical dimension of chip competition playing out?
I think there are two key spheres in which you see it playing out right now. One is that both China and the US are focused on semiconductors, not only because they're commercially important, technologically important, but because they're militarily important as well. The US has a lead in semiconductor technology, but its lead in chip technology has narrowed dramatically over the past decade or so, alongside the US military's lead over China narrowing dramatically as well. And when both the US and Chinese militaries think about the future of defense technology, they're thinking of autonomous systems, for example, which rely very heavily on processing power, on lots of memory, and on signals processing. And all three of those things are hugely reliant on semiconductors. So both the US and Chinese military project into the future that semiconductors will be even more important for military systems. And so when the US military and US strategic thinkers have looked at China's increasing capabilities in the semiconductor sphere alongside China's military investment, which has been really substantial and, so far as we can tell, quite successful, those are trend lines that have left the US nervous. And that ties into the second aspect of the chip war, which is ultimately geopolitical in nature, which is that right now, the entire world economy is fundamentally dependent on peace in the Taiwan Straits, because all of the devices we rely on, from computers to data centers to cell phone towers to airplanes to automobiles to smartphones, all of them depend on chip making capacity in Taiwan. And so as the US military edge in the Taiwan Straits has declined, and it's declined dramatically over the past couple of decades, so too, I think the risk that Chinese leaders think they have a shot at retaking Taiwan grows. And if China were ever to blockade or to attack Taiwan, the impact on the global economy would be dramatic. And the most dramatic impact would be on semiconductors, because there's no way we can replace Taiwan's position in the chip industry in a easy manner. It would take years, probably a decade, to build up that capacity again. In the interim, we'd face horrendous delays, not only in things like smartphones and PCs, things that you think are dependent on chips, but autos and aviation and consumer goods. We'd have trillions of dollars of costs associated with that loss. And that gives the Taiwan question, I think, a pressing importance that it might not otherwise seem to have. And the fact that the security of Taiwan is being shaped by a military balance that is itself being shaped by semiconductors shows just how intertwined the geopolitical and the technological aspects are here.
Mm-hmm. Beyond our present moment, though, you've written that, and this is a quote, since the invention of the transistor in 1947, no item has had a more decisive role in international politics, determining the rise and fall of nations, shaping the military balance, forging globalization. Can you talk a little bit about why it's had not just such an extraordinary economic and technical impact, but this political one?
There's one thing that makes semiconductors unique compared to many other types of technology, and that's the rate of change. In most industries, we think of a 5% improvement or a 10% improvement every single year is a pretty good rate of improvement. But in semiconductors, we've had exponential growth, so a doubling of computing power every 2 years or so, which is why it costs a billionth less than it did in 1960 to store data or to process data. That's why we have a billion more transistors per semiconductor than we did then. And that growth rate is something we don't see in aviation. Planes aren't a billion times faster, or cars aren't a billion times cheaper. You know, no other part of the economy has that type of exponential growth built into it. And that's why control over this extraordinary asset, the ability to produce exponential increases in computing power, has been so important. Controlling nothing else has the same amount of growth built into it. And I think even you think about like oil, for example, which is often thought to be a really strategic asset. Today, Saudi Arabia produces, depending on the year, a tenth or so of global oil production. Well, Taiwan produces a third of computing power every year. So even in simple quantitative terms, Taiwan's a lot more important to the global economy than Saudi Arabia is. And when you get into more specific parts of the supply chain, semiconductors, there's even bigger monopolies present. The best example of which is one of the types of machine tools you need to make a chip called a lithography machine. 100% of the most advanced lithography machines are made by a Dutch company, ASML, which has no competitors and probably never will. So that's a real monopoly in the world, and you can't make an advanced chip without their tools. And that, I think, makes the Saudi princes look kind of second rate in their economic impact by comparison.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask you the question that probably everybody has been asking you that you talk to. What caused the chip shortage that we've been experiencing for the past couple of years? And is it related to some of these issues that we've been talking about in this conversation?
I think first off, to understand it, one of the most interesting facets of it is that there was not a reduction in the supply of chips. In fact, the number of chips produced grew by 8% in 2020 and by double-digit rates in 2021. So we have far more chips in the last 2 years than we had beforehand. What grew even more rapidly was demand. So actually the chip shortage framing is sort of the wrong way to think about it. We had a demand surge that left us with a deficit of chips. I think the second interesting part of the chip shortage is the extent to which it had outsized effect on car production. There weren't delays to anywhere nearly the same degree in smartphones or data centers or PCs. And that's because car makers for a long time had taken their semiconductors for granted. They hadn't thought hard about the chips that go in their cars, with a couple of exceptions. And as a result, they didn't build supply chains that were resilient to unexpected demand shocks. So the reason that the chip shortage was so costly to car makers was because the car makers screwed up, not because the chip production process was poorly managed.
Mm-hmm. And just finally, Chris, on this episode, we've been taking sort of the long view of the impact of this technology. So if you get a little bit speculative, how do you think the world would be different if the semiconductor had never been invented?
Everything we touch today that has computing power, which is almost every device, simply couldn't exist in its current format. We just assume as a matter of everyday life that data can be remembered straightforwardly, or that computing is something that can happen almost without our thinking. You know, for most of human history, humans computed by flipping their fingers up and down. Then they invented the abacus, and that was a revolution in computing. Today, we've got a billion times that capacity on our smartphone, and we just take it for granted. And that's not primarily because of the genius of smartphone designers or because of the genius of Steve Jobs. It's because of the genius of people who invented the semiconductors that made this computing possible. So when we think of tech today, you know, we often think of Google or Amazon or big tech firms, but nothing that they operate can run without semiconductors. And so part of the goal of my book is to say, hey, you've probably underestimated the importance of semiconductors, even though in your everyday life, you touch dozens, if not hundreds of them, and you couldn't live without them.
Chris, thanks so much for your insights on this.
Thank you for having me.
Chris Miller is an associate professor of international history at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. His new book is called Chip War: The Fight for the World's Most Critical Technology.
You are listening to Spark.
You are listening to Spark.
With Nora Young.
On CBC Radio.
I'm Nora Young. This week on Spark's Butterfly Effect series, we're exploring how apparently small developments in technology can have an outsized effect on the world and on the way we live. Earlier, I was speaking to John Delasassi, a computer and electrical engineering professor at the University of Illinois, and Paul Ceruzzi, curator emeritus at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C. Here's more of our conversation. So when do we start to see the broad implementation of integrated circuits, like beyond computers?
Well, I always say that the very first time the public really got a sense of this, and I've got one in my desk, is the pocket calculator that some of us of a certain age use slide rules in physics and chemistry. And all of a sudden, in the early 70s, came this device that did all those calculations in your hand using chips, and suddenly the slide rule disappeared overnight, pretty much. There's a whole group of collectors who love to collect them, but anyway, the calculator, it's interesting. The first calculators cost a couple of $100s, and then now you can buy them for $10 if you bother. You got one on your phone, but I bought one anyway because they're fun to use or practical. But anyway, the calculator was a really big deal when it came out in the 70s, especially ones that came from Hewlett-Packard, which not only could do addition and subtraction, but it could do scientific calculations as well, logarithms and trigonometry. That just drove people wild. Just trust me on that. That people could not believe that you could have this thing in your hand that could do these complicated calculations. And of course, a slide rule could do them, but not very well. And if you're an engineer, you got to use those calculations all the time. And if you couldn't do it on your slide rule, you had to sign up for time on the boss's computer or something like that. Wasn't very practical. So the interesting thing, a little tidbit of history, is that when Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin went to the moon, Aldrin carried a slide rule. Huh. But when the last Apollo mission flew, which was the Apollo Soyuz mission, when it hooked up with a Soviet Russian in 1975, I believe it was, they had a Hewlett-Packard calculator. So, and the Hewlett-Packard calculator had more power than the Apollo guidance computer. Much more, actually. Well, more.
Holy cow.
Equivalent, let's put it that way.
Yeah. So, I mean, these days, of course, it's hard to find anything electronic that doesn't contain integrated circuits.
That's right.
The importance of this during the pandemic, there was a big shortage. So how dependent are we now on microchips?
An awful lot. If you look at a modern automobile, actually, it's a supercomputer. It's a network of supercomputers. They have all this collision avoidance, driver-assisted radar units in the bumpers, all this kind of stuff. For an old wirehead or gearhead who liked to tinker with automobiles, this is not something that people look at with fondness, but that's what automobiles are like. That the whole our whole automobile age, our distribution of goods, this was a big issue during the pandemic, the what they call the supply chain, that it requires these very sophisticated computer programs on very powerful network computers that regulate the supply of things from ships and trains and trucks and everything. So yeah, we really, we need them. No question about that. And it's hard, inconceivable to have a life without them, really, at this point.
It's difficult to overstate just how small transistors have become. Indeed, engineers are now measuring the thickness in microscopic dimensions, measured in units smaller than a nanometer.
Yeah, we're reaching that point. I mean, you know, in handfuls of atoms, I'd say at this point, you know, in interatomic spacing in semiconductor crystals is sort of in the sub-angstrom scale, and we're talking about nanometer nodes, right? So a nanometer is 10 angstroms. You know, so we're talking about handfuls of atoms in these nodes, and obviously, when you get to that size of a feature, quantum effects are obviously critical. I mean, the semiconductor itself is a little quantum mechanical engine. You know, it works because of the fundamental quantum theory of I put arrangements of things together that create certain properties. But yeah, we're getting close to that limit. I mean, you know, you look at the size of a human hair, right? The size of a human hair is something like 25 microns, right? Approximately, I think I think it's on the order of a mil. A mil is 25 microns. You know, you take a micron is, you know, is basically 10 to the minus 6th meters. A nanometer is 10 to the minus 9th meters, right? So you think about that scaling, how much smaller it is compared to anything that we physically have a concept of. And it's difficult as humans to appreciate the scale with which these things are being made, because there's nothing in our environment that we can even relate to easily.
Mm-hmm. So now we're at a place where we're looking for what's sometimes called more than Moore. I'd like to talk a bit about some of the things that you've been working on to increase the speed of integrated circuits. Can you talk a bit about photonics?
I mean, of course, photonics very broadly is the use of devices that emit photons, emit light, and then utilizes that light in ways that are convenient for some application. So, I mean, as an example, fiber optic communications is a great example of photonics, where basically, you know, we no longer can send the amount of information that we need to using electronics, using electrical signals. We need to start using photons to send that light. So optical communication systems are a great example of that. By photonics, you know, we're looking at ways of making those devices better. So devices like VCSELs, how do you improve the optical quality that's coming out of those devices? How can you make them work faster for optical communication systems? And how can you integrate those with silicon? So we're interested in mechanisms to augment silicon by bringing materials like compound semiconductors onto that silicon wafer to augment its functionality.
Do you think there will ever be a brick wall in terms of the limit of the speed we can process information, or is it going to keep getting faster?
You can't really make predictions in this business. It's so crazy. But I think what is really the issue is much more the fact that there's so much more information. If you think of somebody taking a picture of their cat or a video of their cat, which people are doing every 5 seconds.
Sure.
Okay. And they upload it into the cloud. So the cloud, these storage devices, have to store that information in perpetuity. And a 5 second video of a cat takes up more memory than all the computers of the people that went to the moon. You know, they really do.
Wow.
One image, because it's video. So where's all this going to go? Where's it all going to go? And when's it going to end? You can't tell people to stop doing this. And in fact, people invent new ways of generating information. You know, people think, well, information is free. It's weightless. You know, it's just a bit. A bit is a bit. It doesn't have the mass of a machine or something. But when you get into this scale, it really does have. It takes a lot of power, for example, to operate a data center. And where's the power going to come from? So it's an interesting question. I don't have the answer, but it's a very exciting time to be around and looking at it.
Yeah. And Paul, I'll leave you with sort of a speculative question. How do you think the world would be different if the integrated circuit had never been invented?
Well, you know, sometimes we feel our age and say, well, I remember when I had a socket wrench in my hand and I changed out parts on my car, things like that. Well, maybe those days weren't so rosy after all. The world would be very, very different. Yes. Whether it would be better or worse, I really can't. I can't say. That's kind of an unanswerable question.
Well, first of all, it'd take a lot longer to turn things on. I mean, two base systems. You know, you're waiting for things to warm up, and you know that can be for people that are impatient. You know, old tube-based electronics are trying on the patients. But I think that the world would be so different. I mean, if we think about things like where electronics was when we had the tube, right? I mean, you know, we had televisions, but they were massive. You know, we had radios, but they were massive. That scalability is limited. So I think that we would see the world not too much different from the way that it was back in, you know, let's say the 50s.
John DeLisassi is professor of electrical and computer engineering at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Paul Ceruzzi is the author of 8 books and is curator emeritus at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum. You've been listening to Spark. The show is made by Adam Killick, Olzi Sorokina, Samarit Yohannes, and me, Nora Young, and by Paul Ceruzzi, John DeLisassi, and Chris Miller. Follow Spark on your favorite podcast app, and you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, where we are SparkCBC. I'm Nora Young. Talk to you soon.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.